If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
This is Words Matter with Norm Ornstein.
We've got the votes and screw the rest of you.
And Dr. Kavita Patel.
These might be some of the smaller moments, you know, with all the bombshells. Didn't catch people's eyes.
Hello and welcome to Words Matter from the DSR Network. Each week, Norm Ornstein and I will talk about the issues facing our country as we come out of one election cycle into another, and it just seems like a never-ending frying pan of hellaciousness, Norm. And I have to say, this was a week. Today, I think we're going to try to do our best for listeners to touch on kind of the main events of the week, and there were many. I think between the Supreme Court and oral arguments in several important cases, as well as the Trump trial underway in New York in the lower Manhattan District Court, as well as, I would say, tear gas in Atlanta, a scattering, the cancellation of the USC commencement ceremony entirely, protests at Columbia University, amongst other universities, kind of nationwide, you know, unrest, as I would call it, where I feel like, I don't know about you, Norm, I felt like entering into what in Washington, D.C. is known as Nerd Prom. The White House Correspondents' Dinner is this weekend for listeners who might be listening to this after the fact. Going into a weekend like the White House Correspondents' Dinner in an administration outside of the pandemic usually would be a festive event. I don't know. This is a pretty somber time. What was your take, Norm, on the news of the week?
So just a minute on the White House Correspondents' Dinner and in a broader story. Politico had a piece that was eye-opening, which basically said that the reason the New York Times has obsessed about Joe Biden's age is because the publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, is furious with Biden for not giving the Times an extended interview. Now, this came from a reporter or two at the Times, an anonymous source. Other reporters for the Times have, you know, jumped up and said, no, no, this is not true. This has never happened. The Times responded to it with a statement that was mind-boggling, because instead of just denying this and saying they follow the news where it goes, it was a kind of angry outburst at Joe Biden for not giving them an interview, while also saying it doesn't affect our coverage. And I mention that just because my guess is the New York Times is going to have a couple of tables at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and maybe even have somebody on the dais with Joe Biden. So there could be some uncomfortable moments there. That's just one of the side stories. You know, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is usually just a huge amount of masturbatory self-congratulations about how powerful and in touch with everything we all are. You know, I stopped going probably a decade or so ago, in part because so much of it was gawking, people saying, look at this celebrity, look at that celebrity. And when it reached a point where I did not recognize a single celebrity who was there because they were real housewives or
TikTok stars,
cable shows, mm-hmm. or TikTok stars, mm-hmm. But it's also the case that, you know, what made it worthwhile to be there in the past was the entertainment, the combination of a president who usually gave a pretty funny address because they had an army of writers working on it, and sometimes a comedian who could be funny. But now it's all on C-SPAN. So there are 3,000 people packed into this auditorium at the Washington Hilton, and then there are all the pre-parties and all of that too. But that's a side issue. The other two issues are the big ones. And just for a minute on the Trump trial ongoing, it's been stunning in a lot of ways. And what's made it stunning is not that Donald Trump is falling asleep or that apparently he has a terrible flatulence problem that is driving his attorneys up a wall because they have to sit there and endure it, which is coming from the attorneys, apparently, the story. But it's that the prosecution, Alvin Bragg's team, led with David Pecker, the whose National Enquirer was complicit with Trump in this catch and kill strategy, which was to keep any embarrassing stories in the aftermath of the Access Hollywood tape in 2016 from basically emerging in a way that would have completely killed Trump's chances of winning. Now, what's there are a couple of elements of this. Of course, one part of it is since this was, you know, the engineering the $130,000 hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, but it was also about another affair he had, a longer one with Karen McDougal, and keeping her from making the story public. I said to some people the other night that imagine if Veep in the writer's room had been talking about a story like this and said, let's name the guy, the publisher, David Pecker.
Pecker. Yes. I was just going to say, did you actually have some hand in maybe translating this to a Veep script? Because it feels like it is.
You know, Veep writers would have said, no, that's just too obvious.
Too on the nose. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But anyhow, what was stunning about Pecker's testimony, and this is a guy who's had a longtime friendship with Donald Trump, but he's in the courtroom and he's telling the truth. And it was that this was a deep conspiracy where there were meetings with Trump before the election to try and make sure this stuff happened so that the story that they, you know, filed false business records and it was all about legal fees was blown up. But what was a particular revelation yesterday was that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, when she was on the federal government payroll as Trump's press secretary, was involved and complicit in this. Now, we know that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who now is the governor of Arkansas, which does not speak well for the people of Arkansas and the voters of Arkansas, has her own deep and horrific ethics issues and probably criminal offenses surrounding a huge payment for a podium. And there are other things too. But it turns out that the corruption was right there in the White House when she was a federal employee. So this trial could not be going worse for Trump at this stage. We're not over yet. There's still plenty to go.
Okay, but that's only to be bookended by how his Supreme Court oral argument seemed to go.
And I'm getting mixed opinions from the various Supreme Court gurus on this. Everything that I saw leaves me furious and pessimistic.
Everything I listened to, I just caught up with the oral arguments and just the transcript. Am I missing something that they see, that your experts see? What am I missing?
No, I mean, there is at least some sense that they might rule the right way, but here's what we know. We know that, first, Clarence Thomas is by far the most corrupt and disgraceful person ever to sit on the Supreme Court. Here in a case involving presidential immunity question surrounding January 6th, where his wife, Clarence Thomas's wife, Jenny Thomas, was up to her eyeballs in instigating and planning and encouraging. And he did not recuse himself. And not only did he not recuse himself, but he basically talked about how this was a nothing burger. So that was an outrage. Right up there with him is Sam Alito, who made the case, it boggles the mind, that if you didn't grant a president immunity, then he would have more incentives to stay in office beyond his time, that if he has total immunity, he's more likely to leave. And somebody tweeted, so we shouldn't bring murderers to trial because it would be more likely that they would kill witnesses. I mean, it's turning logic on its head. What was also stunning about this is that Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson brought receipts. And it was the reality for people who are supposed to be strict constructionists, who bend over backwards to look at what the framers did or what happened during that time. And Sam Alito made that a core part of his argument for the Dobbs decision and overturning Roe v. Wade, how they behaved back in the 18th century. But now, where we know that the founders and the Constitution writers considered immunity and rejected it for the president, they completely ignored it and didn't want to focus on the case against Trump, didn't want to jump up and down when Trump's attorney said that assassinating your political opponents could be considered an official act and therefore a president would be immune from it. And somehow I wished that either the government's attorney or one of the justices had said, well, what if a president, as an official act, decides to assassinate members of the Supreme Court he doesn't like and get their reaction? Now, Amy Coney Barrett actually asked some pointed questions that eviscerated the case of Trump's lawyers. But what leaves me depressed is it certainly sounds like they're going to do Trump's bidding and delay this as long as they possibly can, and make it impossible to try him on the insurrection on January 6th before the election. And then if he wins, it's all over.
Okay, so that's one of the cases of the week. You and I also discussed what I also have. Tell me if you've also had those same Supreme Court whisperers who are optimistic about the case that was heard on Wednesday, the Supreme Court hearing oral arguments on the administration v. Idaho, or maybe it's trying to, yes, v. Idaho, for Idaho's decision after their total abortion ban to also state that EMTALA does not apply in the state of Idaho, et cetera. Emergency medical, basically that the federal law that requires any Medicare, any hospital that accepts Medicare to provide what we would call stabilizing treatment for someone in an emergency, that does not apply in Idaho. So I'm curious if you heard anything optimistic on that front, because what was interesting is that Amy Coney Barrett in this regard, in this argument, all the female justices actually had very, I think, thoughtful questions, sounded pretty cynical about Idaho's case for, well, if your uterus is in jeopardy, that's really not as much of an organ, or certain organs aren't as important, so that's not an emergency, et cetera. So you could hear the skepticism in the female justices' voices, but the male justices kind of basically like praised Idaho and chastised, you know, this bogus federal law that looked like some sort of backdoor to abortions. And I left being very disappointed hearing those arguments and very concerned. What was your take, Norm? And did anybody feel that was perhaps overly cynical to interpret their arguments that way?
No. The optimism on the other case was a belief that Barrett and Chief Justice Roberts would create at least a 5-4 decision that would you know, throw out the immunity arguments. And not much optimism about the timing of it, but at least there was that. The idea that that would be 5-4 instead of 9-0 is another matter. And this one, I heard no optimism. And I think you hit it exactly right, Kavita, that the male justices are at best indifferent to matters of women's health and women's organs and women's well-being. And Barrett, who is now probably the center of this Supreme Court, which itself is astonishing, but who's trying to be, I think, intellectually honest, unlike Kavanaugh, who is more and more looking like an Alito clone, Alito and Thomas. And, you know, Roberts is proving to be feckless at best. But, you know, the same week that we had stories, including a woman suffering a miscarriage in an emergency room, basically where they would not treat her and ended up in the restroom off the emergency room having her miscarriage. In the same week that we see more horrific stories of women bleeding, of women near death and finding that they're not being treated, that the callousness of the Supreme Court, the unwillingness of these men to understand that this is not just about abortion. It's about much broader issues of how you deal with women who have ectopic pregnancies, difficult pregnancies, bleeding, potentially bleeding to death, and, you know, looking like they're going to uphold a law that says that unless you are at death's doorstep, that they can keep you from being treated. It's just mind-boggling. It's also the case that, as I think it was the great Dahlia Lithwick who pointed this out, it might have been somebody else, with the Dobbs decision, with this case, it is, we're going to rule this way, and the consequences are not of concern to us. With the insurrection immunity case, it was all about, for Alito and Thomas especially, the consequences. Well, if we do this, what would happen? And theoretically, what about a future president? They didn't even want to discuss Donald Trump because I think they know that's a bad place for them to go. And it's just making up legal rules as you go along to fit your own radical ideological predispositions and partisan predispositions. And that is appalling for a court which I believe is looking more like a Russian court or a Hungarian court than what we would have expected from an American Supreme Court.
But it's even worse than that, because there was no question that you would see these kind of ideological splits and kind of, you know, to hell with this notion that the Supreme Court is not political, right? We've given up on that. But it's not just political. It's one thing to be political. Fine, all these, you know, overturn this, do this. They are now, with the argument they made with the Trump immunity trial, this is now what justices, from, you know, my reading the scholarly works and listening to some of the scholars of the Supreme Court, that they're just trying to make up law as they go along. You know, this is like, well, we're just going to create something out of nothing because this is what we want. And that's even a more troubling. It's dark. It's dark. I'm just going to make that comment. It's dark. It's dark.
It is extremely dark. And I will say one more thing about the immunity case, which is this case came up from the trial court, Judge Chutkan, to the DC Circuit. And the D.C. Circuit took some time, but it was time worth spending because they crafted a judgment that was carefully done and incredibly powerful, and that included Trumpist judges who understood that this idea that a president would have absolute immunity from crimes is just ridiculous. And you had Trump judges who understood that. And now you've got Supreme Court justices who just throw it aside for their own partisan and ideological beliefs. And you're exactly right. This is not based on even whether you believe or don't believe in the theory of originalism. This has nothing to do with applying a standard to decisions. It has to do with verdict first, reasoning afterward. And it's just appalling.
It's very troubling. Let's talk about what's coming up that listeners might want to be paying attention to. So we still have kind of the ongoing Trump. Actually, give us a preview of the following weeks, because we know that there's both not only court activity, and there's also theoretically some congressional activity that's of interest. And I would say some ongoing take, Norm, on what do you think is going to continue to happen with this, I called it civil unrest, but just this escalation of this cacophony around the country, all sides, you know, pro this, anti, it's actually, to me, I'm just going to say personally, it's plausible to feel many things. And so we're not going to necessarily get into, you know, exactly how I have watched some of these protests in all forms and hated them. And then on some levels thought, I want these voices to exist and have all around and kind of have like a deeper appreciation for what freedom of speech actually means in the United States. It's getting tested, by the way, but what's going on with a cacophony? You and I was in New York, as you know, recently. I was in New York. If you could have told me that this is where I would be in April of 2024, I would have said, Norm, you must have gotten into a script for Veep and confused things, because this is comical. Mike Johnson on the Columbia University campus, Trump on, you know, going home to like his residence off of Fifth Avenue with basically all of Fifth, all of Sixth lined in like barricades from Central Park all the way to like, you know, whatever lower kind of midtown Manhattan. And then I think at the same time, like tear gassing in Atlanta. What's on your radar to look out for over the next couple of weeks, Norm?
So you're right. I mean, you can't help but have mixed emotions or a cacophony of emotions about what's going on. We have to make a distinction. Freedom of speech is two varieties. The First Amendment is about government making laws that restrict speech. And then there is the norm of freedom of speech. And one of the main mantras on the right has been to criticize the left-wing cancel culture. And they, you know, there's some traction for that, because we've had many instances of speakers who are on the right wing shouted down or blocked from appearing on campuses. There was one instance a few years ago at Middlebury College where Charles Murray, who was engaging in a civil debate about his work with a faculty member, you know, was confronted by an angry and violent mob. So there's something to it. But what we're seeing is cancel culture for them is when you try to cancel people we agree with, not these others. So just this week, I mean, first of all, we have what I think is an absolute embarrassment for USC, the University of Southern California.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Yes.
On this commencement speaker, canceling a commencement speaker before the commencement using the shoddy excuse of a security issue, because this is a Muslim American woman who may have done a couple of tweets critical of Israel. That's, you know, for a university to do that, I think is just cringeworthy and shocking. At the same time, we have Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, the fascist governor of Texas, basically, when peaceful demonstrations are going on that are critical of Israel, sending in police and other law enforcement people to arrest peaceful demonstrators because he doesn't like the speech. And I don't like the speech, but this is a genuine cancel culture done by government officials. Now, I would say I have a little bit of sympathy for university presidents who are trying to create a balance where you want to have freedom and robust discussion, but where it's turned in a bad direction. And when you have, you know, a kind of civil disobedience of setting up tents on a lawn, that's a tough one to deal with. And, you know, what Columbia did, you have a president who first reacted, I think, partly because she wanted to mollify the Jim Jordans and Elise Stefanik's of the world, going in and arresting and having the police arrest people in tents, even when they weren't doing anything beyond trespassing. You know, if you're trespassing by storming into a college president's office and occupying it, that's one thing. You know, those people, those students have gone too far. That is a disruptive thing. At the same time, we know that there have been violent confrontations with students and outsiders, masked ones, harassing Jewish students. We know that one in Yale was poked in the eye with a Palestinian flag and had to go to the hospital, and fortunately did not lose her eye. And we have college presidents who are just standing by and letting that stuff happen, or reacting by shutting down the classes and saying we're going to go virtual for the rest of the year. You're floundering around trying to find a response, but I have to say the response of many of these college presidents, from Yale to Columbia, are just wrongheaded, and they do not reflect what you would hope you'd have in a strong.
So is that a reflection of, for a long time, I hate to say it, these are generally universities that have been sitting on massive endowments that, you know, kind of to be a successful university president was some combination of academic prowess, you know, Nobel laureate, Nobel nominee, you know, revered lab for publication, et cetera, plus some political chops. And then let's add in a tincture in some universities of DEI, kind of like wanting to show that Columbia, right? I think they have, if I'm not mistaken, don't they even have like, I think the Egyptian, I forget if it's an economist. I think their president is a woman, I want to say of Middle Eastern descent, economist. So, you know, you see this kind of recipe across universities. And honestly, Norm, like this is just, you and I have worked and seen a lot of administrations come and go, seen a lot of leaders come and go. It's not the easy times when leadership matters, right? It's the tough times, right? And nobody expects any leader worth their salt, including the president of the United States, to get it right out of the gate, the first get-go. But what seems to happen is like these people don't learn. Like you would have thought that what unfolded at Stanford, which I'm a little closer to, obviously, months ago, would have been some sort of masterclass. Every university president would have been like, let's get in a war room. Let's figure out what happens when this happens on our campus. Let's figure out how to get ahead of it. Let's figure out the policy, et cetera. No. Feels like there probably was some board conversation about it. You saw every university president getting quick to send out the letter condemning the terrorist attacks, fine, but also kind of saying, you know, we enjoy free speech here, fine, but letters don't do you any good when like there's unrest and there's the kind of like emotional distance. And that here we are Friday, we're recording this on Friday, April 26th. And there are still hostages that now have been forgotten, you know, people's kids, people's brothers, parents, like, so who, like, what is, you know, murdered children in a hospital, admissions of, you know, kind of Israeli defense and Hamas, and like, it now feels like it's a train run amok, but that's when leadership matters. And I would say we started this conversation with like Supreme Court leadership, Trump. Not too dissimilar from like why we're disappointed in university presidents. There's actually not like it's the same theme. You should just shut up and lead. You know, people want like something to lead. People want to be led, but also to feel like you're actually like looking at the evidence in front of you and literally like, you know, like the Supreme Court, like that you're not forwarding your personal agenda. It's the same themes. And yet we seem to not learn from them.
No, and you know, You're exactly right. And freedom of speech is all about, it's not about speech that's nice and flowery. It's all about obnoxious speech. And of course, one of the responses to it is you have the freedom to say something horrific and obnoxious, but we have the freedom to call you out and say you are disgusting and obnoxious, much less make, you know, counter arguments. It just boggles the mind that university presidents did not, as we began to see some of this happening in different places around the country, issue statements saying, here is what is acceptable, here is what is not acceptable, and we will enforce what is not acceptable, and that includes trespassing in areas that block people from their freedom of movement, harassing and physically contacting students and faculty on the grounds. Part of it is that you've got plenty of faculty who are doing some bad things as well. Chris Hayes had a tweet yesterday. The chairwoman of the philosophy department at Emory was arrested along with a number of others at a demonstration run amok. And as she was being hauled off, she said, somebody call the philosophy department to tell them I've been arrested. And he said, that's the tweet. That's the statement of the day. Don't call the lawyer, call the philosophy department.
let my chair know I've been arrested. I won't be at the meeting that I said I would be at.
But, you know, most university presidents have been caught with their pants down, frankly, unable to figure out until they have to react. And they've often just reacted really badly to a lot of this stuff. I mean, the other point here is, and it gets back to the old Pat Moynihan defining deviancy down, we're not just seeing people condemning Israel for what they've done and are doing in Gaza. They are saying to Jewish students who are not Israeli, go back to Poland, and we will, you know, the Intifada will take care of you. You'll all die as well, and we hope you're not prepared for it. When you get stuff like that, you know, that's just not acceptable. And that's a level, not of speech, but that's threats and harassment. And, you know, the fact that they're all masked doesn't help any either.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's so funny, just as a final comment, at Yale, you may remember probably 3 years ago, you had a statement from the administration at Halloween saying, please don't wear offensive masks. And a faculty member who was married to the resident dean, another faculty member at Silliman College there, issued a statement saying, this is not how it should be. You should, you know, people wear masks and you're offended by them, then you, you know, speak out about it. That's how we handle it at a university. And the couple got hounded out of their position because students said, we want a safe space. And we had all this debate about what is a safe space. And if you are at a university, the last thing you want is a safe space because you're ultimately going to be going out into the real world and you're not going to be able to demand that people don't say or do things that are offensive. That's the whole point of what a university is supposed to be about. It's to confront difficult issues and obnoxious stuff and develop a way of dealing with it. So Yale has now gone from, oh my God, we've got to create this safe space, to, hey, kids are being harassed, threatened, and physically assaulted, but, you know, what are we going to do about it? And so it's obvious that the tightrope that you're supposed to be walking in these cases is non-existent.
That's right. It's true. Well, on that note, we'll see how next week or the weeks to follow unfold. Something tells me it's going to still get dark before it gets a little bit brighter, hoping that as the country goes into spring and it does get a little warmer, it might get a little brighter as well. But I want to thank you, Norm, for having this conversation with me, and also thank our listeners for joining us. Keep in mind that we would love to have you share this episode or any of your favorite episodes with your friends on social media. And if you like this and want even more of the conversation, please feel free to become a member of the DSR Network. You're going to get access to the bonus segment where Norm is going to give us a little bit of the preview of how folks inside the Beltway are talking about fixing the Beltway, which I think will be fascinating, but only access to that through membership, and comes at about a latte a month, maybe even cheaper, depending on how you like your latte. So Words Matter is a production of the DSR Network. Our executive producer is Chris Cotmore, and the producer of Words Matter is Riley Fessler. The next episode of Words Matter will be in your podcast feeds. We're heading into May. It'll be around May 2nd. See you then.